So now I want to just set a little framework and talk specifically about Tibetan Buddhism, as you both are Tibetan Buddhist lamas. And you know, we don't have to talk forever about this, but just for the benefit of everybody listening, particularly those that may not be as familiar with Tibetan Buddhism, can you just say a little bit about the specific role of music in Tibetan Buddhist practices, thinking through mantras, chants, rituals, instruments, and what they may symbolically represent? Can you say a brief word or two about that in terms of Tibetan ritual?
Mitchell?
Yeah. So first, I would sort of zoom out and just kind of introduce the subject by saying that, you know, what we call Tibetan Buddhism now is Vajrayana Buddhism or Tantric Buddhism. And part of the basic ethos of that is to ultimately like bring all of the areas of experience into the practice state. I think we could say it that way. And in other words, to sort of find the thread of reality or the thread of ultimate reality in all moments of experience. And so based on that perspective, the arts in general have always been skillfully incorporated into the tradition. So music has always been, you know, one of those. But in general, the arts, there's a very rich tradition of the arts in Tantric Buddhism. Yeah, so specifically music is used in several ways, but probably the most obvious is just the array of instruments involved in the group practices that we call pujas. And then of course you have chanting, which is like an sort of integral part of Tibetan Buddhism, chanting texts, and then chanting and reciting mantras as well. And I would say especially those aspects that are just like voice related have to do with what we kind of touched on in that last question, like the vibrational resonant quality of sound, and specifically how that relates to the energy of the subtle body, just in terms of like how it relates to actual practice, like by sort of maybe harmonizing those frequencies, it's easier to find a meditative state. But yeah, and then there's just the more kind of overt, like, musical instrument aspect of it that you find in the pujas and some of the practices. So yeah.
Yeah, so I think my introductory thing here would be just to point out that this kind of practice, which we sometimes describe as being from the third cycle of the Buddha's teaching, is built cumulatively upon the previous two cycles. So proficiency with the foundational teachings helps us be more proficient with the Mahayana teachings from the second cycle, and those teachings help us be more proficient with the Vajrayana teachings. So the reason I'm saying this is because, like, engaging in that sort of puja practice, I believe, is much more effective when there's some sort of already developed skills. Because really, like, those kinds of practices are like kind of like multitasking practices, really, because you're chanting a thing, you're visualizing a thing, you're trying to hold an intention, you're actively playing instruments, you know, like there's a lot going on. I mean, a puja in a way is kind of like a large, like, music composition, in that you're there's a lot of variables that you're aware of and managing, and so all of that to say, like, I don't think you can just dive in and assume that's an effective practice for you. But if you've already had some practice working with placing attention and holding intention, then those types of situations become good, like sort of like Dharma jungle gyms, you know, where you can play a little bit with what you know and have an experience of practice that's closer to what happens in life, because we have to be able to try to maintain attention and intention even when there's a lot going on. So I think those practices are in a lot of ways sort of like applied practice, because we have to navigate multiplicity while also trying to maintain a sort of singular attention and intention. It's also like sensory situation, you know, like we're working with most of our senses in situations like that. There's usually incense burning, there's sound, there's touch in terms of like turning pages and playing the instruments. And so this is a practice of also immersing in or engaging a lot of the senses. And I also, one thing I always think about when I think about Tibetan music, and I want to clarify too, like, this is semantics for sure, but I think of myself as a lama trained in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, but I absolutely an American lama. And there's a number of reasons why I personally prefer that that kind of a designation. But part of the reason is I just don't know that much about Tibet. And to be frank, I'm not that interested in Tibetan culture. And that's changed over the years, but that's where I'm at right now. It's not something I particularly am concerned about learning about or getting more proficient in the cultural Tibetan cultural aspect. But one thing I think is interesting is that we got the sense in retreat that there's this paradox of the melodies and the instruments. There's like a right way to do it, and whoever's teaching you will probably. At least the way we learned, there was a lot of time we spent learning how to do these instruments. And that was because there was whoever was teaching it had an idea that there was an exact right way to do it. It was probably how they were taught. But in Tantra, there's a lot of different lineages and a lot of different teachers, and things come down that are not the same. And so that also brings up the question about like who determines right or wrong. And I think at the end of the day, particularly when you get to the level of the Tantra, whatever is right is what your teacher told you. And I think a lot of times we get into this situation of like looking for the ultimately right thing. But Tantra in a lot of ways is about submitting to what you were taught, you know, submitting to a certain lineage or a certain view because it's what the teacher you put your trust in has given you. And so there is this one level of like doing things right and a lot of practice and training to do it right. But then there's also this aspect of improvisation. And like if you listen to a Tibetan chant, it's kind of wild. Like it's not easy to chant like a Tibetan. And I've heard, definitely heard a lot of white people try it, you know, and it's not, you know, it's that's just not the same. Like, I'm sure there are some who can probably do it, but it's a very unique kind of improvisational chanting and even different amongst Tibetans, you know, it's not like a single thing, but there is this right, this element of rightness. And then there's also this element of just improvisation and creating in the moment. And then there's this third piece, which is you can be wrong with what you're doing in your improvising. So like, to me, that's been kind of like one of the takeaways about Tibetan music to me is like, there's this sense that like, you have to do it right, but there's also this improvisation aspect, but you also have to be ready to be wrong about your improvising. And I think that's like, to me, that's just like a lesson in not clinging too tightly to anything there, you know?
Mm.
So it's interesting. I have one more important question for you regarding this overlapping space. And it was really one of the questions that was the genesis for this whole program. And I have a friend who is a music therapist, and she is a long, long time as a meditator. And newer to studying Vajrayana Buddhism. And she asked me if enjoyment and Buddhism could coexist. And it took me aback a little bit. And her question really stemmed from the fact that in many Vajrayana monasteries, monks are forbidden or at least limited the consumption of worldly pleasures, which includes listening to music. And so I know neither of you are monks, but you have lived as a monastic. And can you speak to that as either... any thoughts on any thoughts on that practice or your experiences with that practice in your 3-year retreat?
You mean like in terms of adopting the practice of limiting pleasures?
Correct, including the consumption of music.
Mm. Yeah. First of all, I don't know exactly where her question came from her own experience. I totally understand that question coming up. From my own experience and viewpoints, it's not at all a surprising question, because it actually, Mitchell and I recorded an episode that I haven't released yet a couple weeks ago, where we talked quite a bit about how Tibetan Buddhism is making its way into the West, and how that transition or merging is going, you know. And I think that there is a lot of misunderstanding about that kind of idea. Like, are we allowed to be happy or have joy or enjoy things if we're serious practicing Buddhists? And so I think just a blanket general answer is absolutely yes, and you should enjoy things. But in terms of individual practitioners taking individual paths, like a monastic path, I think that any of those, whatever it is that you're renouncing, is the practice is the renouncing. It's not the not doing. So what I mean is, like, the practice is being mindful of what the discomfort of not doing a thing that you actually like to do, or that you have some attachment towards. And so it doesn't really even matter what it is, but monastics just happen to renounce a whole lot more. And monastics are often called renunciates, because they're voluntarily choosing not to do certain things in order to engage this practice of having an awareness of not doing it, and then continuing to make the choice not to do it, which you could see would lead to some real fortitude, you know, some real mental fortitude to be able to know you enjoy something and not do it. I'm thinking of when the head of our lineage, somebody asked him, "What's your favorite food?" And he said, what did he say? I think he said meat or something, or barbecue, or I think steak. I don't know. It was some meat thing. And they were like, "Aren't you a vegetarian?" And he was like, "Yes." In that moment, it's like he knew what he liked, and he's still choosing not to do it. And there's a point where you can get to where you actually value that strength or that ability not to engage, and that becomes its own joyful path. I think that's maybe a realized path of renunciation, when you actually get to where there's actual joy in having that experience of not indulging in the thing that you feel like you need. But I also think that there is, you know, part of the reason there are monastics who practice the Vajrayana, the tantra, but in tantric practices, in the context of tantric practices, there is dancing, and there is singing, and there is alcohol, you know, and sometimes there's meat and stuff and other things. So, like, there is also this practice on the Vajrayana level of recognizing that there's something beyond that situation of yes or no, or doing or not doing. And so I think to sum it up, like, renouncing is an individual practice, and we all need to look at what we're renouncing and to what degree individually, and match it with our goals, and kind of almost like a treatment plan if you were going to a doctor or something, you know, like, does this fit the treatment plan, and is it working effectively? Is it causing side effects that are unintended? So I think that and that's important, because I think it's easy for us as Westerners, seeing this culture that's a little different, to say, like, oh, those monks are not doing this or that, so I probably shouldn't do those things if I want to be successful. And it's like, no, that's just the path they're choosing to take. That's their method of practicing renunciation. And there are a whole bunch of other ways of working with that too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, I think, perfectly explained. I would just add maybe a little bit of, like, I guess, historical or traditional context. Like Adam mentioned, I mean, the monastic tradition, if we're going to look at, you know, Vajrayana, tantric Buddhism, the monastic aspect of it is really only just one little part. And also, like, the tradition itself was literally founded on the possibility of people being able to realize awakening without giving up worldly pleasure. I mean, that's just the reality. So I think the thing to keep in mind is just that, like, that path is, it actually requires more maturity. That's not something to just, like, kick back and be like, we don't have to do any work. We can just hang out and do whatever we want. But I mean, the point is that if your perspective is sort of dialed in enough, and if your foundational levels of practice are established, actually, there can be maybe more depth, that we can encounter by not turning away from things, but by incorporating more aspects of experience into our practice mind. But yeah, I mean, the enjoyment of life is, like, potentially, with all due respect and care, I would say, like, the point of this particular tradition. You know, it's basically like enjoying reality to its fullest, but that just includes the perspective of impermanence, non-attachment, all of those things that are very real. Like, we are trying to taste the whole picture, I guess.
I like that.
Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, enjoyment without attachment, I think, is the mantra, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can do that, like, I mean, I guess that, like, in a way, like, all practice leads to that in some way or another, because that's like, we're talking about the fundamental situation of loosening our clinging or our grip, you know, loosening the attachment gradually. So yeah, I don't know where I'm going with that, but yeah, I agree 100%.
Thank you. All right. I want to ask you just a couple questions, particularly about the enjoyment of fish music, and how we pull these concepts together. So, you know, for people that haven't appreciated fish music as much, it's really quite a phenomenon, right? I mean, people flock to fish shows over and over and over again, and clearly it's not because of just going to have the direct entertainment value or the novelty of knowing that, you know, each show is a unique experience. There's something quite spiritual about being particularly at a fish show. What do you think that is?
I think it is perhaps the coming together of, like, practically everything that we've touched on. I mean, I think there is kind of like a ritual aspect of it that people, whether or not everybody's thinking about that consciously or not, I'm not sure, but, like, there is a ritual involved with it, and I think that that must be part of it. But if I really just look at myself, why do I keep going back? I mean, it is that kind of just, like, the energy, like the appreciation, the kind of mutual collective appreciation of something, and, like, the element of novelty, the uncertainty. You don't know what's going to happen. You're sharing in a unique experience with other people, and it's just, you know, we could, I guess part of me is like, we can sit here and talk about all these deep and true considerations about why people might be going. But, you know, it's funny, like, these days, at the end of the day, it's sort of, to me, just simplified into, like, it's just really fun. I mean, that might sound like, I don't always think it's so deep, actually. Like, the deep things are there, and that might be why we have such a good time, but, like, it might not always matter to talk all that out. Like you said in the question, like there's just this undeniable special thing about it. And like, you know, to me, I'm like, man, it's just so much fun. I don't want to sound dumb, but that's the truth. Like, anyway, I think it's a fun, special thing. Yeah. But I also think that probably about everything that we've touched on in this whole conversation, you could see in real life action at a fish show, you know, and there aren't that many, musical situations like that right now. Like, you know, it's an interesting mix of like seriousness, sacredness, good old fashioned fun, but also like serious artistic integrity. You know, I mean, they've brought, actually, the last shows I was at the ones right before you guys in Nashville, and I had a moment where I was like, I mean, if you look at this whole thing with the lights and the musicianship on display, I mean, this is like some kind of like fine art situation, but they're like bringing it down. They're just bringing it down to the level of like a concert that anyone can go to, you know? So that's pretty cool, I think. It's like high level art and entertainment that has like almost like this spiritual element to it, but at the same time, it's totally accessible, you know?
Yeah, I think I also want to bring in the idea of community, both in the sense of just having friends and meeting people and a general overall good vibe from people for the most part. There's definitely some characters on the lot and maybe in shows that are there to turn a profit somehow or another. But I think overall, there's a pretty positive vibe in general. And I think part of that community aspect is that everybody's taken a leap at a fish show. Like, it's not, for at first, the band and their crew, but also definitely us in the audience. I mean, it's kind of, I forget about this sometimes, but like, most people, if they don't hear their favorite couple songs at a concert, like they're angry, you know, like that it's very upsetting if you go to see your favorite band and you don't hear your favorite songs. And the kind of unpredictability you're opting into with a fish concert is very unique. And we're all taking a leap together on that, you know, like we don't know what they're going to do at all. And so there's a neat community aspect to that of everybody taking that jump together. But there's also this meaning-making aspect in the sense that we all are moved by music or jams or and even like certain song selection can feel like it's personal. You know, like when I get a sample in a jar, like I'm getting a little choked up thinking about it now, but that song was my first fish song. And like whenever it happens when I'm there, I feel like it's for me, you know, and it's this thread that goes back through all the shows I've seen. And so there's some serious meaning making happening, which is also often associated with spiritual path in general, is taking things that could be potentially random, good or bad, and making some meaning or connection to ourselves with it. And I think a manifestation of that is like doing picks before the show. Like that's kind of a thing a lot of fans will do before the show, is pick some songs that you think they're going to play or that you hope they're going to play. And of course, we don't know. I mean, we can do some statistical analysis. Like it's been so many shows since they played Ghost, so they're probably going to play that tonight, you know, but we really don't know. And like I made a totally left field pick for the Dayton run on the first night, and I said they were going to play Egg in a Hole, which I don't know that they've even played it twice. Maybe three times or something, but it's like a song off of the album that Mitchell was there when they played it for the first time, the Sci-Fi Soldier album. Yeah. In Vegas, and just a random song. And I just, you know, I had my regular picks like Divided Sky, you know, something standard, and Egg in a Hole, you know, and everybody was like, get out of here, you know. And they didn't play it the first day, they didn't play it the second night. I didn't expect to hear it. Went through the whole second set of the second night, and then the encore, they come out and they do Egg in a Hole. So like The encore, like the whole weekend, was the totally random song pick that I took and stood by, and that had a lot of meaning for me. You know, there really probably not any direct connections between me picking it and them playing it, but at the same time, are there any connections? Maybe there's something, right? Like, and in any case, it's meaningful to me, and it was meaningful to my friends I was with, who were, you know, texting, you know, immediately, like, egg in a hole, you know, like they're all surprised because I picked it. And so all of a sudden we all have this meaning based off of just really what's pure randomness, both on the band's part and on my part. But we made some meaning, some narrative out of it, you know, and it built community. So, yeah.